So generally speaking, a marriage sacrifice, vivaha yoga, as it's known in Sanskrit, is a joyous occasion, isn't it? Everybody's happy when some couple gets married. Everybody comes out to give them encouragement, blessings, and wish them well in their future activities. And of course, take a nice wedding feast, right? That's usually part of the package. Feel a little disappointed if you go to a wedding and you don't get fed nicely, right? So this evening is no exception. We should all be in a joyous mood. Tulsi and Shalagram are going to be married, and we're all fortunate to be part of this very wonderful occasion. And there will be nice feast served at the end. So everybody should be in a good spirit. Tulsi and Shalagram Vivaha Yoga Ki Jai. Now most of you here are familiar with Tulsi Devi, and you may know something about Shalagram Srila. So we're just going to say a few words, and then I wanted to concentrate more tonight on the institution of marriage itself. I'll leave some time to discuss that. Tulsi Devi, as you know, is a manifestation, or you could say an incarnation, of Vrinda Devi. Vrinda Devi is such an important associate of Lord Krishna, Radha, and Krishna in the spiritual world that Vrindavan is named after her. Vana means forest, and Vrinda, of course, is Vrinda Devi. So Vrinda Devi is such an important associate of the Lord that his favorite pastime arena, Vrindavan, is named after her. And in that arena, she's responsible for making all tasteful arrangements. Of course, everything in the spiritual world is tasteful. Here in this material world, it's a world of duality. We have tasteful, we have distasteful. Right? We have aromas and we have odors. There are no odors in the spiritual world. Everything there is aromatic. Everything is wonderful. Everything is beautiful. Everything is tasteful. Still, ever increasingly tasteful. So Vrinda Devi is making ever increasingly tasteful arrangements for the meeting and association of Radha and Krishna and their associates. In this world, she has incarnated as Tulsi Devi, this Tulsi plant. One of our young devotees, he's now not so young anymore, he's graduated from school, but when he was a youngster, he wrote an article for BTG. He was in Boise, Idaho at the time, saying that one of their members, a new member, had said that, "I would like to send my child to your Sunday school, and the child can stay for all the activities except for what at end when you worship the plant. I don't want my child to take part in that." And this is an Indian person. Didn't know anything about the worship of Tulsi Devi. So, of course, this young boy had to inform him that this is a very important ritual. You may think it's just some ritual, but it's a very important ritual. Because Tulsi Devi is so blessed and important to Lord Vishnu, blessed by Lord Vishnu, and so important to Lord Vishnu, to Krishna, that anybody who gives just slight attention to Tulsi, Krishna immediately, you immediately attract Krishna's attention. We know the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya. He came because Advaita Acharya was worshipping him and loudly calling for him to come, worshipping with just Tulsi leaves and the water of the Ganges. Just those two items. So Tulsi Devi is so important in the worship of the Lord. The Lord will not accept any edibles unless Tulsi is presented on that foodstuff. This is how important Tulsi is. And worshipping Tulsi, circumambulating Tulsi, sowing the Tulsi plant, giving Tulsi, all of these things are very activities are very dear to Krishna. Every morning, as you know, we have our Mangal Aarti at 4:30, and at the end of our Mangal Aarti, then we have this Tulsi Puja. And while worshipping Tulsi, we recite this mantra while circumambulating, Yani Kani Chapapani Brahma Hachidi Kani Sa Tani Tani Parashanti Padakshina Pade Pade. That with every step that we take in circumambulating Tulsi Devi, we were actually relieving ourselves of the reaction to countless sins, even up to and including the heinous crime of killing a brahmana. Killing in general is bad, but to kill a brahmana is just like the worst thing you can do for your spiritual advancement. Cuts it immediately. But by circumambulating Tulsi Devi, even that sinful reaction can be alleviated. Now, it doesn't mean that you should all look around the room and look for some brahmana you don't like and decide that, well, I'm going to off you because I can just circumambulate Tulsi. No, I don't recommend that, because even though spiritually that will be true, the civil authorities may not agree with you, so you may still wind up in Sing Sing or someplace like that, so don't do it. But Tulsi Devi, the point is very dear to Lord Krishna. And I know in my own case, when I joined in 1973 in New York, I had been attracted by the philosophy. I didn't know anything about the devotees. I mean, I knew they were there in New York since the mid-60s, but I first met them in 73. And I was attracted by the philosophy. That's what attracted me. So when I started going to the temple, all this other stuff was kind of strange. I mean, very nice, interesting, the smells and everything, but everything was a little strange. But almost immediately, somebody involved me, and I'm trying to remember who it was now. Maybe Devi Shakti or maybe Parashakti. One of those ladies invited me to start helping to take care of Tulsi Devi, to put the skirt on in the morning and to get the paraphernalia together. And I noticed immediately, just by paying a little attention to Tulsi, immediately my interest in spiritual life just accelerated. So I recommend heartily, if you can come for the Mangal Arati, that's good. But those of you who live too far away, if you have a little altar at home and you have Tulsi Devi, any care you give to Tulsi is to your benefit. So tonight we're celebrating this marriage of Tulsi and Shalagram. So now we've heard a little bit about Tulsi. She's an incarnation of Vrinda Devi, very important associate of Lord Krishna. So who's Shalagram? Great. Shalagram is Krishna. This is also something else that people have a very difficult time to relate to, especially here in the West. How is it that this little stone can be God? How is it that this stone statue can be God? How is that possible? Now, if one is spiritually inclined, at least inculcated in the teachings of some bona fide religion, not that you woke up one morning and created your own religion, but if you came up in a Judeo-Christian background or whatever, every genuine religious tradition accepts that God is omnipotent and omnipresent, right? That's why you can pray anywhere. You can be on the beach, you can be on top of the mountain, wherever you are, you can pray to God, and you are fairly sure that God is hearing your prayer, right? Because God is omnipresent. God can hear you from anywhere. It's not confined to the temple or the mosque or the church, or God is not locked up, cannot be locked up. So if God is omnipresent, then why is he not present here, and here, and here, or in the stone statue? Why not there? Or in this temple? Many people believe that their God is not here. God is on the beach, or God is in some church somewhere else, but not in this building. No, God is everywhere. Now, he may or may not make himself be manifest by his will. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, by me in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All things are in me, but I'm not necessarily in them. Krishna says, Bhagavad Gita, 9th chapter. So, he is manifested everywhere, but he's unmanifest to our vision. We may not be able to see him. That's his choice. Another way of showing that God is a person. You cannot force God to be visible to you. God becomes visible when he wants to be visible. That's why Prabhupada used to always say, first deserve, then desire. First deserve, then desire. When you deserve to see God, then God will become manifest to you. Yeah, but you cannot force it. Otherwise, and this is actually our desire anyway, in a conditioned state, we want God to be our order supplier. Everybody would believe in God if every time I said, I want $1 million, boom, it came. This man is attacking me, kill him, boom, the man died. Man, everybody would believe in God, because God is my order supplier. Whatever I ask for, God gives me. Whatever I want God to do, he does. What a wonderful God. But because that doesn't happen, then we lose faith. The classic example probably Prabhupada uses is of the aftermath of World War II. On both sides, on the German side and on the Allied side, the women especially were praying, let my son, my husband, my father, my brother come back from the war. And when they prayed fervently and the son, brother, father, husband didn't come back, then they lost faith. What kind of God is this? How could he allow my husband to die or my son to die? And it's still going on. So many young men and women are going off to Iraq and Afghanistan, and when they die, people lose faith. Because if there is a God, how could he allow this enemy to kill my son like that? So we should understand philosophically that God is not our order supplier. We cannot force God to do what we want him to do. Just the opposite. We should always be ready to do what God wants us to do. That's the whole sum and substance of bhakti. A bhakta, bhaktin, is always ready to do whatever Krishna wants done. Not what we speculate should be done. Whatever Krishna indicates should be. How do we know what Krishna wants to be done? That's why we have the Acharya. That's why we have the Guru. The teachings come down in the cyclic succession. So Krishna is manifest everywhere. And he particularly manifests himself in what appears to be matter so he can accept our worship. This is Krishna's mercy. We cannot see spirit. The proof is most of us, many of us, not most maybe, but many of us have been present when somebody has died. Remember the first time it happened with me. I was a boy, somebody got hit by a bus, person died. I didn't see anything change. The same body that you saw a few seconds ago was still there, but now the person's dead. So what is the difference between a dead body and a live body? The difference is that the soul is gone. But we don't see that. We see the same body that we used to hug and whatever is still there. Still there after death. But we know, intrinsically we know, we say, my father is gone. What do you mean your father is gone? Prabhupada used to say, he's lying on the bed there. The body is there. But no, you say, no, my father is gone. So that means you never knew your father. Because that body that you used to call daddy is still there. But yet you say your father is gone. That means you didn't know your father. You never saw your father. We cannot see spirit with these material eyes. And therefore, Krishna very mercifully appears before us in the deity form. Rukmini Dwarkadish, Jagannath Baladev Subhadra, Shishi Gornitai, and so many other deity forms. It's the Archa Vigraha. The deity form of the Lord is there. Out of the Lord's mercy, he appears in such a way that we can worship him, we can dress him, we can feed him. Otherwise, how do we serve? What service can we perform with our material senses? Therefore, Krishna appears. So one of these forms is the Shalagram form. This Shalagram Shila is not an ordinary stone. You would think, again, in India that everybody would notice, but that's not a fact. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, the spiritual master of Srila Prabhupada, used to say that he does not want that kind of devotee who's using the deity as a stone for cracking nuts. Literally and figuratively. Literally, some people are so foolish they do that. They will take a Shalagram Shila for breaking nuts. And figuratively, because some people, they open the temple and they have gorgeous deities, Shalagram or whatever, just so people can come and give them money so they can eat. But this is not the purpose for establishing the deity. This deity is not established just so you can come here and give money. Whatever money you give in the service of the Lord is for your benefit. It's not that this temple was established for that purpose. This temple was established so that the public can come and hear about Krishna. Because the more we hear Srimatam Sakata Krishna, the more we hear about Krishna, the more purified our heart becomes. Jeto Dharpana Marjanam. Our heart becomes purified, our consciousness becomes purified and elevated. So, this is Krishna's mercy. But it's a well-kept secret. Even within, again, the so-called Hindu tradition, a lot of people are not aware of this. What to speak of outside. Again, in New York, this was about in the 80s. I was at a Sunday feast program just like this. And some young man came, who was a Muslim, very big guy. This guy comes in and says, you know, one of your members invited me to come here, and I came to see what it's all about. So he came in, and we were chit-chatting. And then he just happened, if you know how the New York temple is set up, Skimmerhorn Street, you come in the door, and then there's a huge, you know, like, greeting area, and then there's a set of doors to go into the temple itself. So then somebody opened the doors, and he saw Radha Govinda. Radha Govinda is the name of the deities in New York, my first deities. So Radha Govinda is standing on the altar, and he goes, what is that? So we explain, this is the Archa Vigraha, form of the Lord. God appears in this form. That is not God. That is a stone. You guys are idol worshippers. And it's a big guy. I'm not kidding. This guy was huge. So I'm thinking, why me? What am I going to do? Because he was saying, if I want, I can go and break that stone. That is not God. Oh my God, what am I going to do? So I just did my best past talking and tried to get him to understand. And, you know, he didn't really get it, but at least he calmed down a little bit. But the point is, we should get it. And if you don't get it, keep trying, keep hearing. Because it's very important for us to understand. We cannot approach Krishna in our materially contaminated state. Out of his mercy, he appears before us in this archa form so that he can accept our worship. So that is the form of Shalagram. So today we're going to celebrate the marriage of Shalagram, which is an expansion of Lord Vishnu, to Tulsi Devi, which is an expansion of Vrinda Devi from Vrindavan, or the spiritual kingdom of God. Which brings us to the point that I wanted to stress tonight, this whole business of marriage. Why marriage? What is the purpose of marriage? You'd think that this institution has been around for so many centuries, so many thousands of years, and still people are asking, why marriage? What is marriage for? Should we get married? What is it all about? Recently there was a survey done here in America, And I think the number was 46% of the people think that marriage should be abolished. That it's meaningless, it has no meaning, you know, who needs it, you know, let's just get rid of it and be done with the whole thing. And in a way you can't blame them, because in their experience, the majority of people that they've seen married, including probably their own parents, were either A, not happy, or split up, or something bad happened. So as far as they're concerned, it's not a good thing. It creates problems, enmity between people, you know, families break up. Somebody was saying recently that some young girl was a little upset because her parents were still married, because all of her friends, the parents are separated, and they get to go sometime with mommy, sometimes with daddy. And you know how it is when the parents break up, they compete to give the kids everything they want. So this kid was upset because her parents were still together. So, this institution of marriage, why does it survive? Why should it survive? Why do we recommend it? In the beginning of the movement, Srila Prabhupada was even himself doing this marriage ceremony. He was personally getting his disciples married. He said, no more this boyfriend-girlfriend business. You're going to get married. So why? Why stress that? So we understand from Vedic culture that marriage is absolutely necessary for proper functioning of society. For society to function properly, you need qualified, high-class citizens. Citizens who are properly trained as to what is the goal of life and how to achieve it. The marriage creates families, which are the building blocks of communities, which are the building blocks of nations, etc. But if you enter into the institution of marriage or into the house of marriage without properly understanding why it is necessary and how to properly execute that particular responsibility, then obviously you have the kind of situation where we have today, that we have today, where so many people get married just on a whim. And this is predicted in the Srimad Bhagavatam, that in the Kali Yuga, people are married just on a whim. They'll marry just because of sexual attraction. And when an attraction wanes or breaks, then done with you, I'll move on to the next person, whatever like that. So this is not the kind of marriage that we're witnessing here. Yadyadacharati Shrishtas. Krishna sets the proper example for every facet of our lives. So included in that is this Vivaha Yogya. When Lord Krishna himself appeared, Swayam Bhagavam Krishna, the original form of Krishna, when he appeared 5,000 years ago, how many wives did he have? 16,108. So that was 16,108 perfect examples of what married life should be like. He properly took care of each and every wife, not that they all had to line up to see him once in a while. Every single wife had her own palace. Every single wife had 10 children, servants, everything was there. Now we can't even imagine, we can't even start to dream about marrying more than one wife. It's not possible. When Prabhupada first started the movement, he discussed openly, he said that traditionally in Vedic culture there was polygamy. Because there's always a certain segment of the male population that's not available for marriage, either in the Vedic culture because of renunciation. You have your brahmacharis, some remain lifelong brahmacharis, you have your sannyasis, you have your vanaprastas. So there's a small segment of qualified men that are available for marriage, and generally there are a lot more women available, and therefore there was polygamy. But it wasn't something that was done whimsically. A man had to be qualified to take care of more than one wife. So Prabhupada discussed openly and then finally said, no, in this age it cannot be done. You cannot even take care of one wife properly. So don't even think about it. Forget it. So that's finished. No polygamy. But what does it mean to take care of wife? What does it mean to be married? What is the responsibility of the wife? What is the responsibility of the husband? These things are not taught in society at large, and therefore we have the kind of marriages that we have. People rush in and rush out. And it just leaves a trail of broken hearts and psyches, and what to speak of the children. Usually they're the ones that are the most horribly affected by this irresponsible marriage. So the part of the mission of the Krishna Consciousness Movement is to promote, by philosophy and by example, proper marriage. Marriage is one of the sankskaras that should be entered into by civilized personalities. It begins with the Garbhadang sankskar. This is where life actually begins. The parents should announce. Property cessation should not be done in secret. Parents should announce that we're going to try to conceive a child. And then the blessing is given by the spiritual master, the brahmanas, the whole community. Then they try for the child. And then when the child is born, there are so many other sanskars that should be performed. Then this Vivaha Yoga is one of those sanskaras, one of those stations of life that we should, that most of us should pass through. There are some rare individuals that can remain celibate for life. But if you don't get married, property cessation, none of this bachelor daddy business. I'm not married, but I have a child over here and child over there. No. If you want children, then you get married. If you don't get married, then don't have any children. Don't have any sex life. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to. So this marriage is a very, very responsible step on our progressive path for spiritual advancement. And it should be taken seriously. We have a lot of young people in our community who are not married. How many here are not married? Put your hand up. Let's just do an informal survey. Or not married. Doesn't matter what your age is. If you're not married, put your hand up. And those who are married, put your hand up. So it seems like tonight the marrieds outnumber the non-marrieds. So this Tulsi Shalagram Vivaha, for those who are married, is a chance to renew your vows, to renew your commitment to your partner. As we've seen, many of you have seen before, but again, we will see tonight, that there are vows taken during this marriage ceremony. There are vows taken. This marriage is supposed to be for life. Today we were entertaining some students. Very nice professor that's been coming on a regular basis, brought some students, so we were discussing this point about marriage. And one of the young ladies asked, you mean, because I said, marriage in Krishna consciousness is like the, when you go to a fire sale, you buy it, it's yours. No returns. You can't bring it back. It's not the library system where you check it out and then you take it back. This is not mine. This is Sura. Sura is very humorous. This is something that Sura says all the time. So she said, you mean there's not even like a 30-day trial period? So I said, in a way, yes. You can check out the prospect before you say, I do. But once you say, I do, it's supposed to be for life. Okay? And why is that? And again, it's philosophically, there's reason for everything. Because there's no guarantee that if you dump this one and then go over there and marry that one, then things are going to be any better. Is there any guarantee? How many times have we seen somebody, I'm tired of this one, they break it up and then they go over there and the same thing happens again. Because wherever you go, your mentality goes with you. So if you don't reform your mentality, what makes you think you're going to get any different result? You're half of the equation, isn't it? If you're involved in a relationship, you are half of the equation. So if you're taking the same mentality from this relationship to that relationship, chances are you're going to get the same result. So you might as well stick it out. Might as well stick it out. Through thick and thin, happiness and distress, health and sickness. That's why we take these vows. It's supposed to be taken seriously. Not that because I wake up today and, you know, I don't like you anymore and therefore that's it. No. Shouldn't be like that. Human life is a life of responsibility at every step of the way. So that includes marriage, and what to speak of when children are born, then the responsibility increases. Then you're not only running the risk of messing up your own life, now you're messing up the life of the children that you've brought into this world. So the point I wanted to stress tonight is that it is a joyous occasion. Marriage is generally, again, we just generally get happy when we go to a wedding ceremony, but we should see beyond just the immediate, you know, festivities that are happening, we should see what it means. What does marriage mean? And enter into it with that properly educated mentality. That it is a lifelong commitment. It is meant for producing high-class offspring. Because as Arjuna was saying to Krishna in this first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Adharma Bhivavad Krishna, Pradukshanti Kula Shriya, Sri Shu Dukshasu Kante, Jayate Varna Shankara, that this Varna Shankara, unwanted population, will come into being if the women are not protected, if the religious principles are not followed. So marriage is meant to be entered into with this understanding. It's very, very responsible. And if you don't do it in a responsible way, then we have the situation we have now where there are so many unwanted children even within the family. Unwanted doesn't just mean that, you know, they were unplanned. It means they parents give birth to them, and because they themselves are not properly cultured, then they literally don't want their children anymore. They don't want them. They just can't wait for them to grow up and leave. Get away. So I can again be free to do my thing, you know. But this is not the mentality of one who's actually cultured. A cultured person enters into marriage understanding that it is for procreation, for bringing into being, or actually being a channel for souls to take birth. And then your responsibility is to, as far as you can, inculcate them into spiritual values of life so that society as a whole can go forward towards achieving the goal of human life. Otherwise, we see, having a nice child doesn't just mean that they are born with all the limbs intact. That's what it means nowadays. If the child is born with no defect of any kind, then, oh, I won the lottery. You know, no mental problems, no physical problems, we won the lottery. But what they don't understand, that because the mentality of the parents are shaping the offspring, they may look perfect, but internally they could be rotten to the core. The case we like to use to illustrate that here in California, many of you are aware of, the Menendez brothers. Born into a wealthy family, the parents were millionaires. And they looked like normal guys, but they were so hellish hard, so hard-hearted, so hellish mentality. They couldn't wait for the parents to die to inherit. They killed them. So if we don't do a good job of giving birth to spiritually advanced personalities and helping them to advance spiritually, then you may run into the situation where your old offspring wants to kill you. So it's a very, very serious and heavy responsibility. It is a joyous occasion because that responsibility is not meant to be borne alone. Spiritual life is meant to be engaged in actually as a community. Yes, as an individual, you can go back to God with nobody's help if you're so serious and so sincere. But generally speaking, we need the help of each other. We are supposed to go forward as a community. So similarly, when you get married, the community should be there to help to raise the children properly. There should be so many eyes, so many ears, that the kid doesn't get away with anything. That was kind of my case. My mother was a teacher, so I didn't get away with anything. Anything I did, your mother's a teacher, you should be ashamed of yourself. Don't do that. So it should be like that with the community at large. The children are meant to be raised by the community, not just by the mother and father. That's too big a burden. But nowadays, because, again, the community can't be trusted, you can't blame the parents for locking up the kids at home. But that's not how it's meant to be. So our society, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, is meant to set the proper example for how to live human life and how to achieve the highest goal. And it includes this very responsible step along the way of getting married and producing spiritually advanced personalities. So we can stop here. Now we're going to have the yajna, so everybody can again face the yajna arena. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Tulsi Shalagram Vimaha Yogya Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Go back to Vrinda Ki Jai.